Today I had the pleasure of sitting down with a man that grappled with a gambling addiction. He's used his lessons from his past and he's gone on to build a successful coaching business. It's not just any old coaching business. He's moved into the 10X program released by Grant Cardone himself. I give you Dave Montgomery.
Dave.
Cody.
What's happening?
Wednesday, Winsday.
Very good.
Fucking my favourite day of the week.
we'll start from the start. We'll go through your story and then we'll get into what you're doing now.
No problem.
So if you want to start from like, we'll go from your childhood. Give everyone a good insight.
As I said before at the start when I walked in, I brought some props with me. So I'll start with my parents. I've got better props than this first one, but they helped me kickstart. So I've got better props than that. But I'm here because of my parents.
Yep.
Only child, 52 years young, the son of a shopaholic. My dad was an enabler. They were creatures of habit. They grew up in the around the time of the Vietnam War leading through the 70s and 80s. Mum and dads were creatures of habit. Dad worked shift work. Mum worked Dad worked shift work as a fitter and turner. Mum worked for Medibank, Medicare, and they held down the same jobs for years. They didn't play sport. They just did whatever they did, and when they brought me into the world, then I had to do whatever they were doing. But I was happy enough. I was an only child. I got the latest gadgets, Dick Smith Wizard, Commodore 64, fucking Flintstones record players. If only I had kept all that shit, it'd be worth a fortune. But I went to public primary school, public high school, did nothing fantastic at high school. My first job was working at McDonald's at 14 and 9 months, and that was probably my real sort of first flavour into what it was like for other people growing up, for other people that played sport, other people that had siblings, other people that did, I guess, more challenging things in their life than just live the routine that their parents lived. I then went on my first holiday with some of the McDonald's crew. We went up to the Gold Coast, up to Brisbane, to Expo 1988. So that was my first flavour into... I remember my best mate who passed away. I used his driver's licence and we hired mopeds. And I got booked by the coppers for for riding on the footpath. And... we'd already teed up that when we were going into clubs and things as to, hey, well, it's important to know your star sign. You've got to answer certain questions just in case they ask you as bouncers. And what do you know, the coppers thought straight away that, fuck, this guy's too young. I was only 17, but they thought, fuck, there's something a bit off here. And but I managed to get it past the coppers. And so I got a fine. I paid it for my mate. We then went to through the trip. We went to Conrad Jupiter's Casino on the Gold Coast and I played a poker card machine type thing, the machines that they used to have in the pubs before they had poker machines. And I didn't really have a win, but I just sort of had my first furore. We went upstairs to the nightclub. I got my first hookup, had a party pash with this chick. I think she was 17 or 18.
So she was all sneaking in.
Yeah. Oh, we all got in. Like we all had like different ID. But what the bouncer should have been checking is that the ID that I was using for my best mate, there were three of us using his ID.
Uh-huh.
So like one of us would have had his paper license, one of us would have had something else, but they never checked the names or anything. And but anyway, that was the first holiday that I had away from my parents, and that was good. I picked up another chick.
I want to say that this podcast is only possible because it's sponsored by
Big Bull Supplements. I myself built this company from the ground up and would appreciate it if you go check it out. I'll leave all of the links in the show notes.
That was the daughter of the owner of the accommodation we were staying at, and her name was Roxanne. And she came down to Sydney, and she was down there for a couple of days, and I didn't do anything fantastic at school, and I had to make an excuse to my parents as to why I didn't want to be at school, and it was only so I could spend some time with this chick. And they said to me, they said, well, if you obviously don't want to be at school, so you better go get a job. And so what do you know, I went and got a job. My cousin got me a job at Terry Shields Toyota at Parramatta on Parramatta Road there, just at Granville before the before the freeway sort of got changed to where it is now. And I worked as a clerk, and I used to have to file pieces of green paper numerically and pieces of yellow cardboard alphabetically. And that was all my job was. But then we had the service department down on Parramatta Road, and we had the new car showroom up on Church Street. And so I'd have to go and sort of take mailbags up between the two sites. And so doing that, I was able to, something that should have taken me 10 minutes, I was then able to take it, it'd take me an hour. And I'd fucking go and get a pie, or I'd go and look at the car auctions, or I'd do something sort of in between this bullshit thing. And I stayed at that job for, I think, 6 months. And coincidentally, in the parts department of that company that I was working at, my brother-in-law to my wife was working there at the same time, without me knowing. And I, obviously I didn't become part of that family for, I think, another 15, 20 years. So that was that was crazy. And so I then went from that job to a girl that I worked at McDonald's with. She was working at a chemical company just down the road from where we were, and that was a company called Ajax Chemicals, and I started there as a clerk. And once again, I was just filing pieces of paper, but I was we were in support for the customer service people. And I left school in year 11, didn't know anything about science, but I stayed at that company for 2 years, and because of the interpersonal skills that I had, the support that I would give the sales reps, the knowledge that I had, and I was just a, I was just positive. And because of the bullshit life, the boring shit that I do at home, going to work and being around other people was a fucking Disneyland to me. It was working with people that would do things after work, would go on holidays, and that was fucking out of the ordinary for the bullshit, boring life that I lived. And so I went well with that job, and then one of the reps left that company and went to like one of the biggest chemical companies in the world called ICI. And he said to me, he said, oh, look, I'd like you to come and work here. And so I went and got a job in their customer service department. And so I was 20, I think, about to turn 21. And I was the youngest customer service person without any sort of qualifications, degrees that they had working there, that I was in a team of six different customer service people. And they all had degrees. They had, they'd been to year 12. They'd been high achievers. They'd been school captains. And here I was, this sort of young guy from the western suburbs that left school in year 11, and I was just a nice bloke. But I could talk to people. I could, and so I stayed there for, I was in customer service for 18 months, 2 years, and then a position came available as an account manager. And so that was, so I'd gone out of customer service. I then sort of showed them that I was willing to, I'd turn just people placing orders into upselling them. So I then got a job as an account manager, and once again I broke all sorts of records because I was the youngest person with without any qualifications, and I just picked up all this chemical knowledge that no one else had ever really picked up that didn't have qualifications. And I became an account manager, and I got a company car, got an expense account, get tickets to the football, and it was the type of thing that was in the mid-90s, but it was the type of thing that from an account management and a sales perspective, if you weren't spending money, you obviously didn't know your customers too well. So we would fucking go to the football, we'd go to concerts and all this stuff, just to build rapport, just to sort of get to know people better. And that was really good. And then I stayed there, I think, for 4 or 5 years. And then something happened and I had someone move to another chemical company and they said, oh, why don't you come and join us here? And that's where I met my wife. And so I worked there. But around this time, the key thing that I've left out of it is that I went from that chick that I picked up at Conrad Jupiter's, the chick that I met Roxanne at from the place up at Expo, to then I started going out with a girl, I think it was around about the time that I was at ICI, who then became a company called Orica, that I was with a girl called Pippa. And I was her family, it was her mum, their stepfather had passed away. There was the mother, Sue. There was Pippa that I was going out with, and she had two sisters, and I was the man of the house. We were living up at Grosvale, North Richmond, and it was brilliant. It was, once again, I had responsibilities. They had cows. They had all these things that, and it was, and I don't have any props for the cows or anything, but yeah, it was brilliant time of my life. And I was with them. I was with her. I was with Pippa for 3 or 4 years, and still had relationships with my parents, but I sort of lived my life through the responsibility and being the man of the house of this place up at North Richmond. And then Pippa and her family went away on a holiday to Fiji, and I stayed back and I looked after the property. And when she came back, she said to me, she said, oh, look, she said, I don't know whether we should stay together because I was kissing boys over in Fiji. And so she did the right thing. And but, man, I was devastated. So I had to move back to mum and dad and fucking in this dark house at Carpenter Street, St. Mary's. And it was my first time actually getting help mental health-wise. I went and saw a relationship counsellor up at North Richmond. And it was the first time that I'd truly spoken to someone about my feelings. And it was brilliant. It was like I was speaking to someone that had no judgment. I was speaking to someone that they didn't offer me any answers. Just by simply talking like you and I are talking, I was actually coming up with the answer, but he would then sort of reflect to me and sort of give me accountability and maybe give me actions or things that I had to do for next time. And the thing I learned out of that relationship was that I gave too much to the other person and I didn't love myself. I love the other person. I love the other person's family, but I needed to not give as much as myself. I needed to get to know me. And so that was brilliant. So then I got in a relationship with my son's mother, a lady called Fiona Cunliffe. And I met her through a friend. She was into horses. And so now I think I'm mid to late 20s. And she's went to a private school. She was the youngest out of 3 or 4 kids. Her dad was a successful doctor. Her dad had some addiction issues in regard to alcohol, but he was highly thought of in the Western Sydney area. They had some domestic violence in the household, unfortunately. But I went out with this girl for 2 years, I think. An okay time in my life, but the thing that I found in that relationship was that she looked up me, even though she had a dad, she looked up to me more as a father figure than as a peer. And we stayed together for a period of time and then we broke up. And unfortunately, I kept on rooting her, and then I was rooting all these other chicks. And eventually she gets pregnant.
Dave and the Shagger.
What's that?
Dave the Shagger, you got around here.
I should have pulled out my cologne or something. I should have had my own range of cologne that I could then put on the podcast.
With that, what brought you to reflect that she looked at you like a father figure? What in like What made you come to that conclusion?
I didn't pick it up until I actually met my wife, where I then saw the way that my wife and I related to each other as to, shit, why do I relate more to this person than to my son's mother? And it was because she made me feel needed. She made me feel wanted. She was very emotional, a bit unstable. And so it was sort of, I would put her in a place, I wouldn't put up with the bullshit, but it was all like she would just suck the life out of me and it became very draining. And so, and it was only further down the track through different reflection, different understanding about who I am that I could then see, I think I actually learnt in when we get to part of my recovery and part of my the counselling that I went through, I learnt about how people are either codependent or they're counterdependent. And I'm going to fuck it up, but people that are codependent need other people. They need to suck these people into their lives. And people that are counterdependent rely on maybe other people doing the work for them. And I think I'm sort of in the middle of the road with that. So I went out with my son's mother. She got pregnant and the baby was due, I think, in January. She went into early labour in November. And my son came along 2 months early. I was thinking as to like how much of the story I need to tell. But anyway, there was a bit of an incident and I got bitten by someone at this venue that I used to work at. And so it meant that when my son came along early, I couldn't give blood for him. I was meant to give blood transfusion.
Yeah.
And but anyway, he recovered sort of he was 2 months preemie, but they let him out then generally around their due date. And they let him out. She came back to my bachelor pad to live for a while with my son. And even though she had my son with her, I fucking couldn't put up with her. She was fucking even worse. Because obviously they go through whatever stuff they go through
chemical changes.
Yeah, chemical. Anyway, so she went back to her mother's place and I think within about 3 or 4 months I'd been working with my wife at this chemical company but we'd never been together and it was on the last day that I left this company that I then hooked up with my wife and that then meant that the relationship with my son's mother, she went from being sort of this unstable, this emotional person to now being fucking the devil. How on earth could I be in a relationship with this new woman when why aren't I good enough?
Yeah.
Well, you're not fucking good enough because of fucking that you and I just aren't good together. So she then moved away with my son up to Coffs Harbour and she completed an education diploma to become a teacher. My wife and I, we hooked up in the January. I think by the following March we got engaged, and then between March, and then I think we got engaged. Then we got married the following January, and my wife went off the pill. Because we wanted to have even though I had my son, I really didn't have, it was a bit of a rocky thing that we couldn't see him very often. And my wife, I'm an only child. My wife is the youngest of five kids and she had nieces and nephews, so she wanted to have a family and financially we could afford it. So so she went off the pill and she fell pregnant like that. We then got married I'm about to pull my first prop out. We got married on the 27th of January 2021. I've got better props than this one. Oh, no. There we go. Montgomery family, 27th of January 2021. So that was when really sort of things started coming together and sort of stepping up to the plate that I'm a husband now and fucking taking the relationship to a next level. I'm part of a family that I'm now the brother-in-law to, I've got three brother-in-laws, a sister-in-law, and then I've got nieces and nephews, and I never really had that.
Yeah.
And I still got the relationship with my parents, but then I've got my wife's parents who, excuse the French to mum and dad, but they're a bit more normal than what my parents are. And so that was brilliant. So we then sort of go along. The baby then comes along on Ebony. Got another prop. I'll pull that out in a second. But Ebony was born on September 11, on the day the buildings came down. My wife was a week overdue. And they said, look, the baby's quite big, so what do you want to do? So my wife elected to have an elective caesarean. And so there's a photo that I've still got to find. I don't know where the photo is. My wife will know where it is. But it's almost as though that at that pivotal moment, there's a photo of me taking my wife in to have the caesarean that morning. And it's as though that there's the life before my kids and there's a life after my kids. And that whole scenario, you've got kids that they say that kids fucking change your life. Unbelievable. That pivotal moment that we took my wife in to have the caesarean, we had to get to the hospital at 6 o'clock the next day. And, man, I remember the baby classes that we went to and thinking that, fuck, look what's going to happen at these birthing things and what's going to happen to my poor wife. And so that was quite a pivotal moment. And then that time when we took my wife in, and then, of course, the baby comes out. She's a whopper. She's 10 pounds, which is 4.68 kilos, and she comes out with black hair, and my wife says, oh, how about we call her Ebony, E-B-E-N-E, she's fine. My son's got autism Asperger's, and so by then he's, I think, 18 months, maybe he's 2 years old. No, 3 years old. He's 3 years old. So we're not really worried about sort of what may happen with my daughter, but we're, of course, just a bit more cautious as to potentially what may happen. And she's fine. The only delay that she's had was she was a bit delayed in her speech, but she's made up for that now. And so anyway, so the prop that I've got for my daughter is these flippers. So my daughter's a marine biologist. And so she was born on September 11. She was fine. She's fucking an absolute rock star. She went through primary school, no issues. I didn't play sport when I was younger. So everything that I didn't do, because my wife did it when she was growing up, it's not as though we consciously thought, oh, shit, we're going to do everything that you didn't do. But we did these things because my wife did all these things naturally growing up. So my girls danced. My girls basically did whatever we could do to occupy their time, to keep their minds busy. Because when I look back, I was bored and I just watched TV and did whatever because I had nothing else to do with my time. Whereas my kids have always been busy. My kids have always had stuff to do. And so Ebony, we waited until Ebony was out of nappies to then start trying for the second one. And the second one took a little bit longer to fall pregnant with. And so Ebony was born on September 11, which is the day the Twin Towers come down. Chloe was born on the 26th of February 2024. And what's quite ironic is the 26th of February 1998 was the first attempt on the World Trade Center. So it's crazy that the two kids have got dates line that relate up to that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was when they tried to bring the Twin Towers down when they bombed the car park. So Chloe was born, and once again, I was an only child, so I just know that kids grow up. But what I noticed with my two girls growing up was that even though Chloe was 2 years younger than Ebony, Chloe didn't know that. As far as Chloe was concerned, she was the same age as Ebony. And so as soon as she got mobile, well, if she saw Ebony doing something, picking up a bag, doing whatever, well, she thought, well, of course I can do that. And so between the ages of 2 and 3 and 4, sort of, it was, they talk about the terrible twos,
yeah,
but it was the terrible twos for us because Like she would do things, but she would be a bit destructive or sort of smash different things, just trying to do things that the 3 or 4 year old was now doing. And I've got a couple of props for Chloe, but I'll pull those out in a minute. And so anyway, so we go along fine. The two girls are along. The girls are doing dancing. The Ebony started doing roller skating. We live down the road from a roller skating rink in Western Sydney, and the good thing about roller skating is that they start to learn balance. They start to learn routines and memories about sort of knowing that, all right, I've got to do these jumps, I've got to do these certain things at these different times.
That's why I think sport's so important for kids, man.
So critical. It teaches you about teamwork, teaches you about discipline, teaches you about respect for your coaches, how to communicate.
How to show up.
Man, sorry? How to show up. 100%. Resilience. But also, not to most quit. Important thing is how to fucking lose and how to – because not everyone can win. The worst thing that they bring out now with kids and whatever is I think there's some soccer teams now that when you play, there's no winner.
Yeah.
And it's almost as though, what the fuck? It's terrible. You learn more from your losses than what you do your wins.
Massively. At least double. At least double.
So anyway, so my kids are quite busy. My kids are doing whatever. They're living their life and I'm just working my life and supporting my wife and my kids. Everything's the way it sort of should be. I'm now at that time in my mid-30s. We're paying bills, we're sort of paying our house off, everything's okay. And I unfortunately then got introduced to a thing called a self-managed superannuation fund by a friend. And that unfortunately gave me access to money. I was DJing at the time, so my wife didn't work for the first 10 years while the kids were growing up. So I worked two jobs so that she could stay at home with the kids, because when I was growing up, both my parents worked and I had to grow up with my grandmother. So I at least wanted an environment where at least one of us was always present with the kids. But working at nights and DJing, I would have a bit of downtime and sort of going up between then that point. I wasn't really – I would gamble every now and then, but gambling wasn't it wasn't an issue. It was – it was only an issue sometimes, and my wife would always put a limit on it. But unfortunately, when I set up the self-managed super fund, there was, I think, $60,000 that I had access to that in hindsight I should have – one, I should have never done it – but I should have had a lot more controls, a lot more accountability that I didn't have. And so anyway, unfortunately, because you can get out – I had a key card associated with this superannuation and I had a $1,000, I think, limit you could get out. But if you could sometimes withdraw $1,000 before midnight and another $1,000 after midnight. And I would sort of go and gamble – either between times, between seeing people in my rep jobs, or I'd do it in between bands playing when I was DJing. And Anyway, over a period of, I think, 3 or 4 months, $60,000 fucking gone.
All gambled.
All fucking gambled.
Wow.
It was either sports betting, and I don't have a prop for that. The only prop that I have for that is a fucking boxing glove that my wife fucking should have taken to me over the head with. That at some point a bank statement comes in the mail and my wife opens up the bank statement and she says, what the hell is going on here? And I say, well, hey, look, I've done what I've done. And she says, she gives me my first gift of accountability.
And were you straight up honest with her or? 100%. Righto.
No bullshit.
Yep.
But obviously I wasn't honest with different things in the lead up to that. Through so I wouldn't
– yep.
Yeah. So and there would have been times that I would have just bullshitted to her, but it was lying. It would have been, oh, hey, well, what are you doing with this? Why are you buying certain things? She would never really question me about my time. But whenever she would ask questions like, why did you buy the pinball machine? Well, I bought it because it was an investment or something to do with the superannuation.
Yeah.
And I was just bullshitting. I was just talking through my hat. Somehow I would link it back to something. But and the stupid thing was is that I was gambling all this money, but no matter how much I won, it was never enough. It was almost the worst times when I was gambling was when I'd actually have too much money. Yeah. I'd have like $3,000 in cash sitting in my pocket or sitting in my bag, and I would then have to try and plan time when I'd have to go and do something to then go and gamble to, for some stupid reason, to actually win more. And I wouldn't stop and wouldn't sort of come back to being present truly with the kids unless I had nothing, and or unless I'd gamble that $1,000 for that day. And it's fucking stupid.
How dark did it get when you were gambling? Like, what?
Well, I was escaping. So it got dark because I was escaping that I was working, but I wasn't really achieving anything. I was treading water. Our bills were slowly getting bigger. I'd recognise that, hey, I'm now in my mid-30s. What the fuck am I going to do in my later 40s and 50s? I've got no qualifications. So here I was. I think mentally I would be thinking, I'm going to gamble. I'm going to do these things. I'm going to buy myself qualifications. I'm going to do these things. So I think I did have a so-called plan for it, but I really never had a plan.
Do you think it was just you trying to justify your actions inside
your
own
head to
yourself?
Yeah, I was trying to justify my actions, but I was also trying to escape. When I think back to when I was a kid, I was an only child and I was given instant gratification by my parents. I was given instant gifts.
Yeah, that's important to say, because everybody is given instant gratification now, not just only children.
Instant gratification is fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
It's in sex.
It's on your phone.
It's on your phone. It's escaping certain things. What is – so we come to – I'll pull out one of the props early. One of the things that turned my life around, Atomic Habits by James Clear. A good habit is hard to do. A good habit is delayed gratification. It's something that you get over a period of time. A bad habit is fucking easy to do. A bad habit is potentially gambling, fucking all sorts of things. It's fucking watching porn, whatever. It's a bad habit is easy. So I'll come back to that. So my wife basically says, look, sort your shit out. You need to do something. So I went to Gamblers Anonymous the next day. I stayed with Gamblers Anonymous for 2 years. I became a leader in that community. But the great thing that Gamblers Anonymous taught me was that by other people sharing, there are a lot of people that were there that their rock bottoms was a lot worse than my rock bottom.
Yep.
My rock bottom was my wife opening up the bank account and me fucking gambling $60,000. Other people's rock bottom were the result of other people, like potentially a father or a family member or someone in their life had committed suicide, and that created family sort of tragedy, family whatever, and maybe there was fathers or alcoholics or whatever else, and maybe they'd gone to jail for gambling, maybe they'd committed fraud, all sorts of things. So the thing that Gamblers Anonymous taught me the most of is that thank God that my rock bottom was just losing my superannuation.
Yeah.
It could have been a lot worse. But what I did notice about Gamblers Anonymous was that it was all about the gambling. It was all about sobriety. It was all about not gambling, which is important. But it's not until I get to further through my recovery later on where I discover that you've not only is it good, obviously, not to gamble, not to do these things, but you've then got to go and start to understand what led you to go and do those things. So I go from Gamblers Anonymous and I somehow find a thing called GROW, which is a 12-step mental health program. And it's only by going through GROW and also then finding another sort of gambling counselling thing through Wesley Gambling Centre. And that became a bit more about sort of life type stuff. I had two counsellors, a lady called Pat Hazelton, who's passed away. She's from out west, and a great guy called George Bowie, who I still talk to this day, and he's potentially going to be doing something in the program that I now run. And so I still check in with him. Here we are, I think 15, 20 years later from when I first started going to some of his groups. But the reason why I was very close to George and Pat is that their counselling wasn't so much about the gambling. It was more about the what happens in your life, giving you some life skills. Stuff as simple as phototherapy, that having some photos on a table and saying to someone, hey, if you had to pick a photo that represented how you're feeling, what photo would you pick? And you pick a photo and then you talk through stuff about your feelings. And as a 30 or 40-year-old guy at the time, we don't fucking talk about our feelings.
Yeah.
And so it was great. I'd go there and I'd go to Grow and I'd go to these counselling sessions, these group counselling sessions with Pat and George, and it was brilliant. And so sort of things then sort of go and flow along, and I'm still not gambling. And my son's now getting older. He's succeeding. He's in mainstream school, but in the support class. He then goes from a local public school to a local public high school. He's autism Asperger's. Sort of things still stay a bit rocky with his mother until she gets a partner. And so she gets a partner, and then sort of things start to sort of steady out a bit. But it's hard as a dad that I've got my relationship with my son, but I've got my relationship with my daughters, but my relationship with my daughters are obviously different because they come out of the relationship with my wife, but they also live with me.
Yeah.
So it actually took me quite a long time to sort of understand the dynamics of my relationship with my son, because he grew up in a different space to what me and my daughters are.
How did you find the adjusting? Like, what?
Hard. It took me 10, 15 years because I would always try and change it. I've also then got the disability of my son having autism Asperger's. And it wouldn't be that I would try and cure him, but I would try and challenge him on certain things. I would try and so I'll pull out a prop for my son. Sorry, I'm just going to move this for a second. So as dysfunctional as my relationship is with my son, and he's a relationship with his mother. That's a prop for my son, a Star Wars telephone. I think I actually bought that with the with part of the self-managed super fund.
Oh, wow.
I bought a Star Wars pinball machine, and then I bought some Star Wars collectibles. Now, that's actually got a battery in it, but unfortunately the batteries don't work, but it does ring. And anyway, the back of the helmet is a telephone. So I've got my son. He goes through primary school, then high school. He then gets in to be a prefect in the support class, and typically anyone in the support class isn't a prefect. So he goes along and he does some fucking great things. He then during that time, he hooks up with his first girlfriend, a lady called Taylor. We'll come back to her in a minute. Then roughly about the same time, my girls, they go through primary school, go into a public primary school, nothing out of the ordinary, everything sort of normal, roughly the same. Life. Ebony, the oldest, is doing sport. She's travelling across Australia with my wife. The younger one sort of tags along, and then at some point the younger one gets a bit bored with tagging along, so that she then starts to stay at home with me a little bit more. So that's Chloe, the younger one. I'll pull out the prop with her. So the prop that I'm going to pull out for Chloe is a butterfly, some perfume that's ironically Chloe, and this old camera. She'll be pissed off that I took some of these things out of her bedroom. She's got a bookshelf set up. But the reason why these things are important for Chloe Chloe's had some health issues. So the reason why the butterfly is important is that the butterfly is a symbol for eating disorders. And as a dad, I was close to, I've been close to all my kids, but particularly close to Chloe because she would spend a lot of time with me because Ebony and my wife would be at roller skating, doing different things, travelling across Australia. And so it would mean that we'd have to do certain things together. And as a dad, to you think you're present, you think you know what's going on with your kids, but we didn't become aware of my daughter's eating disorder until she started fainting. And you think, you know, and now in hindsight, going back and looking at photos, the alarm bells fucking should have been ringing for 6 months before she started fainting. Mm. But it's when we then start addressing the eating disorder, we then start going to family counselling through a thing called CYMS, C-Y-M-S, or maybe C-H. It's some sort of child mental health service that the government run. And we'd go to a counselling session where they would talk to Chloe first, then they would talk to the family unit. They would hold her accountable having to do different things, having to keep a food diary, doing different things. And gradually, like over a period of, I think, 18 months, 2 years, she overcomes the eating disorder. The end part to overcome the eating disorder, I shared with you once before, and I always share this story with people, and I'm going to tell you the shortened version. But she says to me, "Oh, Dad, I want to get a dog." And excuse the French, but I say to her, "Chloe, how are you going to look after a dog if you can't look after yourself?" And she says, "Dad, I'm going to sort my shit out." And what do you know? The next weekend, we go and get this fucking dog. And I should have brought him as a prop. But he saved my daughter's life. He's a pain in the ass, but he taught her. What I think then happened is that we still had to look after the dog. We had to do different things, but it gave her responsibilities. It gave her another outlet, something to focus on.
Yeah.
Part of the thing is we go through the recovery from the eating disorder and talking to the counsellors is that my daughter's had some chronic health issues with autoimmune disease, alopecia, losing hair and different things. She's also had some friends that have had eating disorders that have been slightly different types to hers. But the eating disorder my daughter could control, but the autoimmune issues that she had, she couldn't control. So it's almost as though that the eating disorder manifested and got even bigger, the worse some of the other health issues were. And eventually the eating disorder becomes the worst thing. But what do you know, my daughter then gets this dog and coincidentally she then starts working through all of her shit. She starts putting on weight. She starts eating back normal. She finds a boyfriend, Hayden, this young redheaded bloke that's got a mullet. He's got a Commodore. He lives out at Silverdale. He's a high achiever. He's studying to be a haematologist.
Yeah, right.
All my kids are winners.
Haematologist with a mullet.
Yeah. All my kids are, and a Commodore.
And a Commodore.
And but all my kids are winners, but also the boyfriends that they go out with, they're fucking winners. And but yeah, it was amazing, like, to see my kids go off on this trajectory. And I said to my wife, the key thing with Chloe as well is that academically, both her and her sister, Ebony was always, she wasn't a high achiever. She was like someone who'd always get 75%. And she just sort of cruised through. As she got into year 9 and year 10, she started to develop a passion for science and a passion for biology and a passion for the environment. They go to a Catholic girls' school that costs us an absolute fortune. But she then decides to go to a selective senior high school because of the science stream that they offered. And that turns out that was the best thing that both my girls did. So Ebony then goes through year 11 and year 12 at this selective senior high school, St. Mary's Senior High, and it's like a university. There's I think 600 or 700 kids that are there, but it's only the 2 years. You call the teachers by their first names. So even though you're going through year 11 and year 12, it's as though you're at university,
yeah,
but you're still at high school. And Ebony, I think, gets an 82 or maybe 78 ATAR. She gets in to do, she was maybe going to do forensics, criminal forensics, but so at some point she pivots and she decides to go and be a marine biologist. And that was the reason why I bought the flippers. And she's now successfully completed that. She's done her thesis. She's about to start her doctorate and she's fucking winning life. And then Chloe then sees the pathway that Ebony's gone through and she overcomes the eating disorder. And then we come up to a pivotal point where does she stay at the all-girls school or does she go to this selective high school just like her sister did? But Chloe's not doing anything fantastic academically and we say to her, come on, you should do it. And for whatever reason, she was, it was at the end of the day, it was her choice and she did it. And just then COVID comes along. And what do you know, during COVID, Chloe smashes it out of the ballpark. She does, she's a, so you got to remember with the eating disorder, she became a bit of a creature of habit, a creature of routine. And with what she then had to go through learning during COVID, that sort of helped her in a certain way. So she becomes, she goes from being in the bottom 30%, 50% of all of her grades to now being in fucking 75, 80% of all of her grades. And even though she had an eating disorder, she ended up finishing year 12, coming first in food tech. And she came first in food tech because she understood all the problems with nutrition, but now she turns that into a superpower and she understands all like the science about food.
Yeah.
So she came first in food tech. She came first in a thing called CAFS, which is something to do with social science, something to do with like how you should treat people and welfare and different things. But when you look at that, I link that back to the process she, that she went through with the counselling and the process of sort of understanding recovery and different things. The key thing that I've left out of all that is probably just before both the girls started their senior high school, unfortunately, we have some family tragedy. My son's girlfriend committed suicide and it was around that time that that I end up relapsing with my addiction. So the suicide was quite triggering because thinking back to when I then started Gamblers Anonymous and some of the stories that people would share in those groups, that they would always link it back to something devastating that would happen in their life and then they would escape their addiction. And then I start to understand more about addictions and things. But it was then sort of quite harrowing to see, well, fuck, my son and my whole family have now got this suicide that's impacted on us all. And to then think, well, how do I now manage this so it doesn't devastate our family unit and devastate my kids? And unfortunately, relapse. I was working at Sydney Markets, a place at the time, and I was being bullied and I gambled for a week. Unfortunately, I can't remember how much I gambled through. Maybe $500 or $600. I gambled at a local pub that was right there on the precinct of the markets. But we then came up for Anzac Day and it was on Anzac Day 2017. I decided I'm 40, what are we, seven? I think I'm 48, 47 at the time. And I decided at the time that as life goes on and as I get older, life isn't going to get easier. Life's going to get harder. So I go back to committing to my sobriety, hiring a coach, getting part of groups again. I started being part of a men's mental health group as well as a busy dad's type unit, a thing called High Performance Father. And I start losing weight and I start reading. So I pulled out the book before, Atomic Habits, that I then sort of go through sort of coaching and I quit being an employee. I start working for my brother-in-law for his transport company. I start doing side hustle work. I start getting trained in sales and marketing to be either an appointment setter or a closer. And then we come to 3 years ago, so just before COVID, and I find a thing called 75 Hard, which you and I are going to do in a couple of weeks. And what 75 Hard does, it starts to teach me about having the courage to start things but being consistent. Because what I used to do through my recovery, and my wife would always remind me of this, is that I'd go hard but I wouldn't be able to keep it up. I'd burn out, I'd get injured, or I'd be the king of doing something new, but I wouldn't do it long term.
You'd be the sprinter, not the endurance runner.
That's right. And so 75 Hard is about doing the same things for 75 days, being consistent. And by no means was I ever consistent. But it also taught me about, with 75 Hard, it taught me about that when you have those failures, yes, you go back to day one, but you don't let day one be fatal. That you just go back to day one again.
What triggered you to be more consistent? Because obviously there's the program, but anyone can start it. What within you, at what point did you think, fuck this, I'm just going to stick it guns blazing now?
Well, the thing that led me to want to be consistent was that in the process of losing weight, I would go through these campaigns of losing weight and then stopping and then actually putting all the weight back on plus more. And I got around about the time when I started, just before I started 75 Hard, I got diverticulitis and I got shingles all within 6 months. And so once again, I had that chat with myself to think, well, fuck, as you get older, fucking more things are going to happen.
Yep.
So I then was learning that if I continued to push myself as hard, I was maybe going to have a heart attack at some point, because you can't out-train a bad diet. But also I knew that as each time I would get heavier, I would start at a higher weight. At some point, I'm a ticking time bomb for a fucking stroke or a heart attack. So I needed to – my true battle is my nutrition. My true battle is my consistency. And so it's only by finding 75 Hard that I'm actually doing things a lot easier and a lot better than what I've ever done before, but you can do it at a sustainable, consistent rate. And it's only by reading. So some of the key things in 75 Hard is you've got to read 10 pages of nonfiction a day. And I hadn't read a book for 35 years. And what reading teaches you, it teaches you about knowledge from other people. It sort of challenges your mindset. So I go from reading Atomic Habits. I then read Robin Sharma, The 5 a.m. Club. And so what Robin Sharma and The 5 a.m. Club talk to you about is changing your habits, but also changing the shape of your day. Getting up, and rather than being a slave of what happens to you in your life and what happens in your day, be the architect and be the creator of a great day rather than the consumer of just whatever sort of day is going to happen.
Yeah.
And executing each day isn't just about being present in the day. It's about getting your clothes ready from the night before. It's about having a plan of attack for the next day. And so the 5 a.m. Club, it wasn't so much that it was a great book to read. The audio version of it was actually quite easier to listen to. But the community that sort of was around and getting other people that were getting up at 5 a.m., it was infectious. It was brilliant. So, and it's only by starting to do those things and being around 75 Hard, being around other dads groups, that I then decided, shit, I need to do my own program, or I need to do some sort. I started coaching with other coaches, but shit, I need to start doing my own thing. So I find where I'm at now, with Quality Mind Global, and I'm now doing my own coaching program. I'm delivering their content, their curriculum, but for my life story.
Yeah.
And the difference between a counsellor, a psychologist, and even a coach is that you've got people that are giving you theory or listening to you, but they're potentially never sharing their own journey. They're not talking about real life experience. And the what we do is I'm a mind mentor and I talk to people at a peer level and I talk to people from real life experience that potentially you might be a CEO, you might be a person with an alcohol issue, whatever. The basic existence we all have is that we all have 86,400 seconds in a day, which works out to be we've got the same amount of time. It's a case of what do we do with that time? How do we then manage our sleep? How do we manage our rest? How do we manage the fuel for our body? How do we manage our mindset? How do we then manage the relationships that we have? So strip everything back to a basic level that we're all here, that we're all in this present time, that the past is the past, the future is the future, we may never get the future. So how do we just now all exist? And I take something from every program that I've ever done, whether it be Gamblers Anonymous, the stuff that I did with Pat Hazelton and George, the different stuff that I've done from whatever coaches and with the curriculum that I've got with Quality Mind Global, and I now take people through a program, whether it be a six-month program or a three-month program. There's 1 hour's worth of Zoom that you do a week, and then you've got an app that is like your journal, and it's basically like having Dave in your back pocket. And I've got real outcomes that people are getting in their lives, and they're either just staying well at what they're doing or they're addressing whatever problem they may have in their life. We've got a thing called the Wheel of Life where you score yourself on sort of where you're at in different parameters in your life, and you take where you're at in week one and then you take where you're at every 3 or 4 weeks, and we then start to score yourself on what you're improving, what you're not doing, and it's about Cody sorting Cody out but with Dave's help.
Yeah, right.
And the when I look back and you say like about the way my son's mother was in that relationship, that my past is the past, me gambling away my super, they're all things that just happened. And I've let go of the toxic shame. All of it was learning experiences. All of it was unfortunately a gift that I can learn from, and it is what it is. I can take positives from it. I can take reflections from it, and I can use it as a fucking superpower to move forward.
Well, it's led you to where you are now.
And it gives me the opportunity to both continue to be sharper and better as a person, growing forward every day, to providing the right environment for my kids, and to whatever happens in life is going to happen. So I'll just talk through some of the other props that I brought along. I brought along the basketball. That was for my wife. That when I met my wife, she was a basketball player. My wife kicks, and I brought the boxing gloves for my wife as well, because my wife gives me tough love. My not in a domestic violence way, but but more in she'll give me the feedback. She'll fucking give me the kick up the ass that I need.
How important is that?
Without
that, are you where you are?
The problem is it's probably taken me only the last 12 months to figure out the gift that it is.
Yeah.
Because she's telling me things that people may have told me in the past, but I've taken, even from my wife, I've taken as criticism.
Yeah.
She's actually telling me things and she's given me reflections that some of it, yes, I may not need to deal with at the time, but she's giving it to me with love. She's giving it to me with support. Some of it is through frustration, but and that's why the basketball is quite important, because it's about being resilient. It's about bouncing back from problems in life, and it's truly a gift that, like most men, they talk about men are from Mars, women are from Venus, or men are from, I think that's what it is. But it's women are giving you feedback because they want you to be better, and they just sometimes it's just them talking. It's the way they communicate. It's their love language. But men, instinctively, I think we take it all as feedback. We take it as criticism. And there's some things that we need to let go through to the keeper, and there's some things that we maybe do need to respond to, and there's some things that we maybe don't need to respond to there and then. It's something we maybe need to show in our actions or in our the actions that we don't want to repeat down the track. But with the my wife and I have been together now for 23 years. If I look at 10 couples that got married around the same time as us or that grew up around the time that our kids were growing up, and easily 8 or 9 of those couples have gone, whereas somehow me and my wife are still together. The key thing that I left out of it is that when the suicide and everything happened, I also went bankrupt. And that was quite sort of bad for us financially, obviously, but it was also quite a blessing in disguise. It was, all right, well, all my fuck-ups and all my bad financial decisions, there's now a line in the sand. And we're by no means nowhere near as badly off as what we were. The investment that we made in the business, we made that with cash. We made that through savings. We made that with a payment arrangement. But I'm now working for myself. We don't owe any money. My wife's got, I think, a $2,000 credit card bill. I earn money. My wife's got transparency as to where we spend that money. My wife's got control over what we do with things. My kids are much better, more financially responsible than what I am. Ebony paid for her first car with cash. Chloe has got more money in the bank than what we do. So at least my kids, they've learnt from my mistakes. They're much better at life than what I am, than what I was when I was their age. And, man, if something was to happen, I would die a happy man because I've got no guilt. I've got no shame. I've got embarrassment for different mistakes and different things that have happened in my life. But I've got goals, and I've got some pretty big goals for both myself, physically, business-wise, and where we want to go and where things that we want to do. But it's all about the journey. It's all about breaking down that goal to reverse engineering it. And through the 5 a.m. club, I wake up every morning between 4:30, 5 o'clock, and I'd say 6 out of 7 of those days, no alarm clock. It is my body clock and my will to live that's waking me up every day. That I wake up with a purpose, I wake up with a plan, I go and execute that plan. I used to wake up at, I think it's 7:30, 8 o'clock every morning. What do you know, I'm awake 4 hours, 3 hours before that, and I typically don't try and do things for other people until after 2 o'clock, like even though I come with you today. But I try and do stuff for me and my family and for my business before 2.
Yep.
And then I try and do stuff for other people after 2. And what do you know, I'm winning more. I've now got so me and my wife are now empty nesters. We're still together. Our kids are off doing whatever they're doing. They're succeeding. They're winning at life. I've got a VA that works for me in the Philippines that comes up with copy, and like she's better at writing and doing design stuff that I can't do. I've got a tech guy in Nigeria that does all my technical stuff, all my funnels and different things. I've then got a business partner in the UK that we're doing this thing together, 10X, Grant Cardone.
Do you want to speak into that?
So I'll come back to that.
Yeah, back to that. We'll finish
but,
on that.
But I've got I've now got people around me, whereas for the last couple of years I've gone a little bit slower than what I've wanted because I've been trying to do it all myself. So I've now got people that are helping me with that.
What's the importance of building that foundation?
Well, the importance is identifying what I'm good at and what I'm not good at.
Yeah.
So it's and then seeing – so I'm good at the community. I'm good at the sales and marketing. I'm not good at the copy. I'm not good at the finances. So I've then got people that help me with what I'm not good at. And, man, I'm smashing it out of the park. But it's I've achieved a lot in the last 12 months, but what we're about to achieve – over the next 5 years and over the next 10 years, man, what's this space? We are changing the world. We from a sales and marketing perspective, we're building a business that is based on life, that is based on people. That people will get life coaching off us. They will then get sales coaching. the people that get sales coaching, the best coaching, that the best achievers in that sales environment, they'll either go off and work for other people or they'll work in our sales agency. That sales agency will then do performance-based sales and marketing that will either do the marketing side for the client, it'll be the full client acquisition piece, so the full pipeline management. And we'll do that across Australia, New Zealand, Australia, the UK and the US. We've got some potential investors from the tech space that if we achieve our goals, we'll get some investment. But the great thing is that what we are going to be doing is that we're going to be providing something that will help people that can't help themselves, to bring it back from a gambling perspective. When I look back, when I quit gambling, there was all these programs that were out there, but some of them were funded by the government, some of them were funded by the casino, but the outcomes were rubbish. The casino? Well, the casino, as part of their government contract, they've got to give back a certain percentage of their profits to anti-gambling causes. But those anti-gambling causes, the outcomes are rubbish. You may as well, like, you're showing up to programs that aren't worth the paper they're written on. And are they actually delivered? Does the money go where it's meant to go?
It'd be set up to fail for sure.
That's right.
There's no gamblers. There's no casino.
They want you back there. Want you back there. So anyway, there's some pretty big things that we're doing. You and I are going to do 75 hard together. What else? So for this year, I want to do 3 marathons. So I'm going to do 3 marathons. Next year, I want to start doing triathlons. I'm not a very good swimmer. So that'll be that's 2025. 2027, I want to represent Australia in the Masters Games. So I want to start doing shot put or discus. I'll pick something, but... And I can't remember. I looked at the cities that the Masters Games are at, but that'll be then my way of representing Australia. In 2032, the Olympics are back up at the Gold Coast. So we want to do something in our business that sort of links back to the Paralympics and the Olympics community. So we've literally got a 10-year plan for the business. And the Grant Cardone stuff... What we've learnt through coaching is that people are more likely to spend money on their business than themselves. So the way to actually then get people to spend money on themselves is to go at them through Grant Cardone, go at them through their business, and then give them some sort of either life coaching or business coaching, career coaching, whatever they decide to do. So to look at it today, what am I doing? I've of course got to look after me first. If I look after me with my mind, my body, my spirit, I've got to live in a certain way that is quite simple. I live in a certain way, nutrition and stress management wise, that it's a very small circle that I operate in. And then with my business, once again, I strip it all back. There's a very small circle in which I operate. And I don't sort of force myself onto anyone. I knock on doors. If I think back to all the jobs and opportunities that I got, a lot of it was just through people that I knew. A lot of business stuff that I get is just through people that I know, my network. Life's pretty simple. I get up every morning. I've got a rough plan for what I'm going to do during the day. I've got goals. I've got certain things that I want to achieve. And it's always good to have like an event or something that you're training for, and then you just reverse engineer it as to how you're going to get there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get to your goals, sometimes you don't, sometimes you do. You and I will achieve 75 hard. I've never really done it with someone else before.
Yeah. For 75 hard, just for people that are listening that don't know, do you want to list out exactly what it is?
Is it Mark?
Thomas.
Thomas. Thomas, could you pass my phone?
Please.
Please. All right, here we go. We're back. 75 hard. It's about doing 2 workouts a day But one of them has got to be outside. And the benefit I find of one of them being outside is that you're grounding yourself. You're getting yourself outside of an environment. You're realizing that you're so small and the world is so big. Whatever problems, no matter how shit you feel, as soon as you get outside, as soon as you ground yourself in some way, life gets so much more easier.
It's 2 45-minute ones, yeah?
2:45. Minimum 2:45. They can both be outside, but at least one of them's got to be outside.
Rain, hail or shine.
Rain, hail or shine. The other great thing is you've got to take a progress picture. And as much as men will say, oh, I don't fucking take my photo, fucking whatever else, the advantage with the progress picture is that it makes you look at yourself.
Yeah.
It gives you something to compare. And when you've got the progress pictures from day one through to day 75, even though weight loss may not be a thing, I'm going for weight loss, but you actually can, you're looking, you're standing different. It is amazing. A progress picture for any sort of program is brilliant. Reading 10 pages of nonfiction a day. I'm currently reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki.
Great book. That was the first book I picked up.
Really? Well, yeah. Robert Kiyosaki is here the middle of next month and I'm getting to go to his talk.
Perfect. And,
reading 10 pages of nonfiction, one of the best. That and the progress pictures I think are the two best things in the whole program. What else is there? Drinking 1 gallon of water, which is 4 litres of water. The great thing about that is that when you work from home, when you work for yourself, I tend to, once I start eating, I fucking eat all day. I graze all day. And so rather than eating all day, I'll then drink water all day. And the times that I've failed 75 hard, most of the time it's been around the water because I haven't started early and I haven't tried to go all the way through. And if you leave all your water till the back end of the day, it'll then affect your sleep. So it starts to challenge you to remind yourself, okay, well, I've got to start on my water and 750 mils? Yeah, 750 mils. But I've got a 1 litre drink bottle at home, so I know that I know that by 10 o'clock I want to have done 1 litre. By 2 o'clock I want to have done 2 litre. By 3 o'clock, 3 litres and what have you. And so it reminds you that sometimes you'll go through different days or different periods of your life where days will go through, it'll be 3 o'clock by the end of the day without you even blinking. So by having something like the water, which is what you're focusing on achieving through the day, it'll then remind you and it'll break up your day so all of your day isn't shit. Yep. You'll then sort of have different highs and low points through the day, all by simply fucking drinking water.
Yeah.
Following a diet, I'll be following doing intermittent fasting. And I'll probably just have like a 16, 8, some sort of eating window that I'll commit to.
Is that in line with it though?
Well, the rules are you just got to follow some sort of diet.
Righto.
What that is your choice.
Yeah, right.
But the key thing is you're not allowed any cheat meals and you're not allowed any alcohol. So for me,
what's a cheat meal if you're intermittent fasting?
Well, it's eating within the eating window. But also my nutrition is I do calorie deficit. Yeah. So I'll track my calories using a thing called Calorie King. Is it called Calorie King? Yeah, I think it's either called Calorie King or there's one of the apps. But I'm allowed to still eat out and like go and attend a social event as long as I know what the nutrition is.
Yeah.
And as long as I'm eating my calories at the moment, they were 2,600. But now they're 2,400, I think. So as long as my calories are journaled, then I'm sweet. And I don't drink alcohol anyway.
Yeah, neither do I. So quick recap. 4 litres, 2 workouts, 1 outside. 10 pages of a book, a diet,
yeah,
and progress picture.
That's it. Every day.
I'm thinking we should make a joint TikTok or something like that where everyone can follow along. And
why don't we make a Facebook group? Get on board. A Facebook group that is public that people can join and they can watch. And then I think we should vlog our journey is that we keep some sort of diary. We'll get some sort of hashtag. And even if people find it on day 75, people can use the journey. People can start whenever. There's other 75 hard groups that I'm part of. But so I think we calculated that if we start this on St. Patrick's Day, that'll get us to the end of May. And so other times that I think I've achieved it three times, this will be time number four. But whenever I start it with the end in mind, and whenever I start it knowing, hey, why do I want to achieve this, and why is it important for me to use 75 hard in this campaign? I'll turn 53 at the end of July. And I've got some big stuff that I need to do for the business around that time, and I can't do it. At the moment, I'm 116 kilos. So my goal will be that by the end of that campaign of 75 hard, I want to be below 100 kilos. And so then between the 8 weeks, between the end of July, at the end of May and my birthday, I want to get down to 90 kilos, which will then get me to 1 kilo less than what I was on my wedding day.
Perfect.
Because when I'm coaching people, you can't do it unless you're sort of in the best shape. And if people are paying you $3,000 to do a three-month program, they want to see that you're a fucking winner.
Yeah.
And nutritionally and exercise-wise, I'm a winner, but I'm a winner and a loser. I need to win a bit more consistently with that. I need to hold myself accountable to that. And, man, I'm looking forward to you and I doing that and seeing what other people come along for the journey along the way.
So the way I like to finish these, Dave, is your favourite quote and what it's given you for your life.
Let me have a – we'll cut it here for a sec.
Don't even worry
so
about
it. So I just want to think about – because I've got so many quotes. So I think I've got it. So it's my favourite quote and what else?
What it's given you for your life.
Boom. All right, ready to go.
Favourite quote and why? What it's given you. What it's given you for your life.
It's a quote that I got from a thing called GROW, 12-step program, and there's some part of the program, and it was a thing called your feelings are like the weather. And so what that taught me was that things aren't going to always be shit. You sometimes need to fucking just ride it out and the sun will fucking come out. And so even then, since I learned about that quote, obviously things get tough, things happen in your life, but, man, that quote, I've gifted that to other people, but I live through that quote every motherfucking day throughout every day. Shit phone calls that you get, good things that you get. It's almost as though sometimes that I think back, sometimes when things are good, you think, fuck, the bad times are coming. Yeah. But it's also when you realise that, well, the bad times aren't going to last forever. The good times aren't going to last forever. The bad times aren't going to last forever. Whatever it is, fucking just keep on pushing through. Keep on pushing through. And it's so the quote is feelings are like the weather. So that then reminds me to fucking just keep on pushing through. And then it wasn't so much a quote, but it was like a meme or someone sent to me, but it was a meme that was about recovery. And it was maybe a bit of a paragraph, and it was that the best thing you can do for someone if you're working with someone in recovery or if you're working with someone on their mental health, the analogy that I give people is that it's like every day that a lot of men talk about the black dog, about mental health, and it's as though each day we make a decision to consciously work on sobriety or consciously work on recovery, or consciously not be a victim to the black dog. And if we're escaping that personal prison every day, and if we're escaping that prison and you and I are breaking out, your genes get caught on the barbed wire, the worst thing I can fucking do is help you unstick your genes from the barbed wire. The best thing I can do is fucking keep on escaping the black dog. Keep on escaping that mental health prison, because that'll then give you the hope to fucking unstick yourself and fucking follow me as we continue to escape our own battles every day. So I know that sort of isn't a quote as such, a bit of an analogy, but because at the end of the day, no one is coming to save us. We're no one's coming to help us. It's you versus you. It's me versus me. And it's we fucking get out there and we do as best we can every day.
Perfect.
But thank you for having me on the podcast, Brody, Cody. I've got something for you. I've got a 10X badge. And I've also got a copy of Atomic Habits for you.
Cheers, man. Thanks heaps.
Thank you.
I want to say, if you've made it this far, thank you for listening. If you've taken anything out of today's episode, please share it to someone that can benefit from it. Also, go like, subscribe, share on all of our social platforms. They include Instagram, YouTube, Spotify, and everywhere else you find podcasts. This helps us to keep pushing the message, breaking down the stigma, and just talking about the stuff that people don't usually talk about. See you in the next one.